And we're very happy to welcome back to our program Chris Tensing. He's a Middle East Report Executive Director, or I should say Middle East Report Editor, and Director of the group Middle East Research and Information Project. Chris, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much for having me, Scott.
If you wouldn't mind, just say a brief word about your group, Middle East Report, and the Middle East Research and Information Project.
Sure. It's been around since 1971. It was founded by people who were active in the movement against the war in Vietnam, who wanted to bring to the American progressive movement critical perspective on U.S. involvement in the Middle East and also contemporary affairs in the Middle East. And we've basically maintained that sort of orientation over the years. We provide research and analysis of Middle East affairs and international policy toward the region from an alternative and progressive perspective.
And I wanted to invite you here tonight to talk about, which is a certain disturbing trend we see in an already horrific conflict in Syria. Just this week, we've seen a number of developments that we wanted to get your analysis of, and that's calls for U.S. intervention, imposing a no-fly zone by, you know, among others, former presidential candidate and Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham and others, certainly Democrats as well as Republicans. The European Union decision to lift a ban on transfer of arms to the Free Syrian Army Forces. And the announcement of Russian shipment of advanced anti-aircraft missiles to Syria, Israeli threats to destroy those missiles should they arrive. And all of this is happening as the United States and Russia attempt to organize a Syrian peace conference in an effort to reach a diplomatic solution to the conflict that has killed more than 80,000 people since 2011. That's not to even mention the insertion of Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon in the Syrian civil war. A lot is going on this week, and you know, it's frightening to think, although the American people seem to be very tired of the many wars we've been involved with in recent years, that there seems to be some pressure for U.S. military involvement.
Yes, there is some pressure. I guess overall, I'm still struck by how faint and weak that pressure has been. Certainly the war weariness of the American population is a huge factor there. And I think the last poll that I saw maybe late last week was something to the effect that only 12% of Americans asked thought that it was a good idea for the U.S. to intervene militarily. So I'm sure the White House has a very close eye on numbers like that. And I also think that, you know, for all of his faults when it comes to Middle East policy, I think that President Obama himself is just not convinced that armed U.S. intervention or a no-fly zone or something like that would actually be, you know, would actually be a positive development. And I think he's not convinced that it's a pressing U.S. interest to do these things either. So I think that the balance of forces is still against the idea that the U.S. would intervene more aggressively than it has, but that could change, of course, and much hinges, I think, on the success or failure of this supposed peace conference that's supposed to happen. I share what I heard in your voice, skepticism about whether that conference will happen and whether it will be successful if it does, given the other events that you mentioned, EU arms embargo being suspended and the flow of Russian weaponry, and also the reports now that Hezbollah has sent many fighters into Syria to fight on the side of the beleaguered regime. And these things would indicate that the proxy war element of the Syrian civil war is intensifying, and that will, of course, prolong and intensify the fighting, with the primary victims being Syrian civilians.
Chris, can you talk about the possible and future U.S. military intervention in some way, shape, or form? Speak to, if you would, your concerns about this conflict escalating beyond the borders of Syria, and you know, the intervention of other players in the region.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of scenarios that are possible. There already has been spillover of the conflict into Turkey and to Lebanon, to some degree into Iraq as well. And any of these things could happen. I suppose the, in some ways, the scariest possibility is that this would somehow turn into a generalized Arab-Israeli war, or a generalized war of some Arab countries and factions against Israel. If Israel were to become involved, and Israel has hinted that it might resume airstrikes if Russia ships these missiles that can take down aircraft. So that is, you know, sort of the biggest possibility for a regional conflagration. But certainly, with Hezbollah's deepening involvement, the possibility of fighting breaking out in Lebanon more severely than it has already is probably the most real possibility at this stage. And there has been already quite a bit of fighting in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli between forces that are considered to be loyal to the Syrian regime and forces that are considered to be more allied with the Syrian rebels, and that could intensify and spread throughout the country. And certainly the involvement of Hezbollah and the fact that Hezbollah is more and more emboldened about that and openly boasting of it is quite worrisome.
Our guest tonight is Chris Tensing. He's editor of Middle East Report and executive director of the group Middle East Research and Information Project. With John McCain in Syria meeting with Syrian opposition groups and opposition fighters, I wonder if you would just comment on where you think U.S. policy should go at this point, given the prospects for a peace conference sponsored by the U.S. and Russia are uncertain at this point.
Well, I think that one of the most insidious things that interventionists have managed to do with the English language in the last 20 years or so is that they have managed to define the term intervention such that when we hear that term, we automatically think military. There are other kinds of intervention that do not involve joining the fighting, and two of those things would be stepped up diplomacy and also stepped up humanitarian aid to try and deal with the horrible problem of the Syrian refugees who number in the millions and whose needs are not being met by and large and who may be displaced for years to come, given the fact that the fighting shows no sign of ending anytime soon. That is where U.S. efforts should be focused, on forms of intervention in this conflict that have that hold out the possibility of bringing it to a close and taking care of the people who have been victims of the conflict, rather than forms of armed intervention that simply promise to add more fuel to the fire.
When John McCain met with some rebel fighters in Syria, crossing the border, I think, from Turkey, there was a lot of discussion about, and has been over many months of this conflict, the character of the Free Syrian Army and the various elements, the secular as well as the Islamist elements, some accused to be allies or ideological bedfellows of al-Qaeda. How would you characterize the Syrian opposition groups trying to topple the Bashar al-Assad regime?
Well, it's a very, very fragmented group of grouplets that are united only by their desire to see Bashar al-Assad toppled. And yet again over the weekend, there was more discouraging news for partisans of the official opposition that this Syrian National Coalition, which was supposed to be the political address for the international community and was supposed to be the physical address for lethal aid, or non-lethal aid like night vision goggles and things like that, for getting those things to the fighters on the ground, that group again is on the verge of collapse. It's unable to agree upon whether or not to even send a delegation to this proposed peace conference, let alone who the delegates would be. It's really the failure of the opposition groups to get their act together is I think, ironically, one of the factors that has stayed the hand of the West in intervening. but also is a factor that is prolonging the fighting and making things more chaotic on the ground. And in terms of, there is no unified command or control militarily. You have individual commanders on a neighborhood level taking fundraising trips to the Gulf and coming back with bags full of money, and they're the ones who are able to flex their muscles for a while because of the money they can distribute, and then they fade away when it runs out. And it's not really accurate to speak of, you know, the regime on one side and some kind of unified opposition on the other. It's really the regime on one side and numerous rebel grouplets on the other.
Within the past month, there were accusations that one side or the other in the Syrian conflict used chemical weapons. There was a UN report that contradicted some leaked CIA intelligence. And then, of course, what followed were calls for humanitarian intervention, given some of the red lines that President Obama had drawn about the use of chemical weapons. What do you make of that whole episode? As I said, it's a few weeks ago.
I think the interesting thing is how quickly that story was reined in by the White House, in part because they did not want President Obama to be embarrassed by the fact that he had said that there would be use of chemical weapons would be a red line. It is true that in a place like Syria, where it's very difficult for forensic investigators to go in on the ground and take the soil samples and so on that you would need to determine whether chemical weapons were used and what the provenance of those weapons were, it is very difficult to determine who used them, in what amounts, et cetera, et cetera. And so the facts are not really established. But I think that it is interesting how quickly how quickly the White House moved to throw sand in everybody's eyes about that particular story.
Well, on another topic here, which is certainly it's part of a trend now we've seen over many years, and that is that the Syrian conflict, the Syrian civil war, appears to be a flashpoint for increasingly dangerous regional Sunni-Shia conflict. I wonder if you would maybe provide a little bit of history as to how we are at this moment in Syria and across the region with rising tensions between Sunni and Shia, and what your concerns are going forward.
Well, those tensions have been there for a long time, of course, but it's not it's misleading, as the media frequently talks about this being a 1400-year-old conflict between two branches of Islam, and that's quite misleading because, of course, Sunnis and Shiites have not been fighting all of that time. And what is true as a broad generalization is that sectarian conflict of all types in the Middle East tends to flare up in circumstances of broader social chaos, in circumstances of the breakdown of the central state, for example. And so, and in circumstances of external intervention that is seen as being on someone's side or another. And so the dynamics that were put into play by the invasion of Iraq in 2003, led by the United States, are the triggering event of this latest wave of sectarian tensions in the region, which is certainly the worst that I've seen in my years of studying the region, and I think the worst in a very, very long time. So it's, given what happened in Iraq, and given the way in which the Iraq war became perceived in the region as sort of redounding to the strategic benefit of Iran as a Shiite power against the, and to the detriment of the Sunni powers in the region, and given the way in which the war is seen as having redounded to the benefit of Iraqi Shia at the expense of Iraqi Sunnis, and then the 2006 war in Lebanon and other events like this that had a sectarian cast. Very worrisome that the Syrian war has taken on the same dimensions, but it was kind of predictable given what has been happening in the region in the last decade. And you know, I think in the capitals of the region as well, particularly in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf, in the Saudi Arabia and Qatar and all of these other countries in the Persian Gulf, I think they very much, unfortunately, view the conflict in Syria through as a sort of, on a regional chessboard, as sort of pitting the Shiite powers of the region against the Sunni ones.
Where does Iraq stand in all this? I mean, and you just certainly summarized some of the history of how the U.S. invasion of Iraq contributed to the heightening of tensions in the region. But where does Iraq stand now in this conflict between Sunni-dominated nations like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others, and Iran, and forces like that of Hezbollah in Lebanon?
In Iraq, the government of Nouri al-Maliki, which is made up primarily of Shiite Islamist parties, has seized the occasion of the worsening Syrian civil war to sort of double down on their policy, their own exclusionary policies. They have pointedly not only not reached out to their Sunni political opponents and other political opponents, but they have engaged in increasingly violent crackdowns on those political opponents, and so this is intensifying the sectarian dynamic across the region as well. The Iraqi government fears that just as some of these radical Sunni Islamist groups that are fighting to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria, just as some of them came from Iraq and sort of sprouted from the various insurgencies that were fighting the U.S. occupation of Iraq in the last decade, they fear that once the fighting in Syria tapers off, that those jihadi groups will return to Iraq to continue their battle against the Maliki government there. This has this war has the whole region on edge, and unfortunately, it's bringing out the worst, most turtle-like instincts on the part of most of the governments in the region.
This the civil war in Syria began as something related to the Arab Spring, according to many observers, calls for democracy and overthrow of the Bashar al-Assad regime. But the allies of this movement, now and it's in the rebel forces they represent, include Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other Gulf states, which are decidedly undemocratic nations themselves. If you were to look into the future in a post-Assad government in Syria, what do you think we'll see?
Well, I would not even venture a guess on that last question. I would just underscore what you said, that at the beginning, the Syrian uprising was a genuine popular uprising. Syria was always a more divided polity than Egypt and Tunisia, for example. It was not directly comparable, but it was a peaceful popular uprising that was making very similar demands to the ones made in Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, and elsewhere across the Arab world. It was the regime and its extreme violence that was the primary bad actor turning that uprising into something closer to the catastrophe we see today. But it was also the meddling of these external powers. And Saudi Arabia, I think, deserves pride of, well, shame of place, shall we say, in not only lending the fighting a sectarian cast, but also turning the overall dynamic and the overall feel of the situation from one of a popular uprising, which had a pro-democratic agenda, to to one of civil war and a much more sort of existential struggle. And of course, Saudi Arabia is not only an undemocratic actor in the region, it is a very staunchly anti-democratic actor. And so I think another way of seeing Saudi and other Petro-Princeton intervention in the war in Syria is not in the sectarian terms, but in anti-democratic terms, that this was one of the tactics by which Saudi Arabia sought to halt the spread of this very inspiring pro-democracy spirit that was in the air in the region in 2011.
The United States and Russia have been on different sides of successive Syrian governments through the years of the Cold War and more recently, and that continues. What's the strategic importance of Syria to both the United States and Russia, and do you see what's occurring there now in this this tragic, bloody civil war as undermining U.S.-Russian relations in the near term?
For the United States, the strategic importance of Syria is largely related to Israel. There are other factors as well, but the U.S. does not have a huge interest of its own in who rules Syria. They simply want to, ideally, they want a stable government there that will not engage in multi-front Arab-Israeli wars. I mean, that's the major U.S. interest in the region, I think. As far as Russia, I think there are some sort of narrow material interests, like the naval base in Tartus, like the arms sales to the regime over the years. But I really think that what's driving Russian behavior in this crisis is simply a desire to poke Washington in the eye and poke the West in the eye and sort of flex its muscles in the Middle East and say to Washington primarily that the unipolar order in the region is over, that Russia is going to pursue a more assertive diplomacy of its own, which will not be subservient to Western desires or guided by the memos coming from Western chanceries. And I think that's kind of pretty much it. And the the immediate context would be the NATO intervention in Libya, which Russia and also China say, I believe somewhat disingenuously, but they say this, that that they were misled, that they did not think that the Security Council resolution with regard to Libya was a regime change resolution, so they feel that they were hoodwinked by Britain, France, and the U.S., and so that sort of torpedoed the any possibility of unified Security Council action with regard to Syria. That's the immediate context, but I think the deeper context is the overreach of the Bush administration in asserting the unilateral power of the United States on the world stage, and Russia seeking to regain for itself in the Middle East and in the world a diplomatic and sort of geopolitical role that is closer to being on a par with Washington. And as far as U.S.-Russian relations, certainly Syria is a very big irritant. But I mean, I think it's sort of emblematic of a slow shift from the basically unipolar world order of the 1990s and the first years of the Bush administration to a more classically multipolar world order.
Well, thank you for that, Chris. I just have one last quick question, and that relates to Turkey. You mentioned the violence in Syria spilling over into Turkey. There's been air attacks, I believe, of forces of the Assad regime crossing the border in Turkey. But we've had some recent militant protests in Turkey and police violence in that nation. And I wonder how you think that relates to some of the policy positions taken by Turkish leader Erdogan, if any.
That's a very interesting question, and these rather inspiring protests in Turkey, which Erdogan has been going out of his way to say that this is not a Turkish Spring akin to the Arab Spring of 2011, but it does have quite a few similarities that can be drawn. And these protests in Turkey started out with regard to local issues. urban planning things, and also the increasing authoritarian overreach of the Argelian government itself on domestic policy. But there are people in the squares in Istanbul and other Turkish cities who are protesting the Turkish involvement in the Syrian civil war, and this, I think, undercuts the image that the Turkish government would like to present, that the Turkish people are supportive of Turkey's own foreign policy orientation, where it has sought to be a bridge between East and West, and has sought to throw its own weight around on the regional stage. And there's a lot of dissent in Turkey regarding Turkey's increasing from 2011 through 2012, its increasing interventionist stance of its own in the Syrian conflict.
Well, we've run out of time. I thank you so much for helping us understand a lot of the more complex aspects of the Syrian conflict and the regional concerns that I think we all have about where this might go. So, Chris, thanks so much spending
You're
time, and we'll talk again soon. Take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye. That's Chris Tensing, Middle East Report editor and executive director of the group, Middle East Research and Information Project.